From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a new look at Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. Taylor Branch is the author of the new book Parting the Waters, America in the King Years. Carolyn Heilbrunn is a feminist and professor of literature who says that literature has failed to capture the essence of the female experience. Heilbrunn is also a detective novelist writing under the pen name of Amanda Cross. Coming up, she discusses both aspects of her work. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of Fred Astaire's Singing with Jazz Accompaniment. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Roots the Gift. It's another sequel to the miniseries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The new book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, was just nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for General Nonfiction. My guest is the author, Taylor Branch. He says that Martin Luther King's life is the best and most important metaphor for American history in the post-war years. Branch's book is both a biography of King and a social history of the civil rights movement. Taylor Branch is a former staff member of the Washington Monthly, Harper's, and Esquire magazines. He's a white journalist, and he thinks whites have generally measured King's importance according to his impact on white society. Branch wanted to overcome the pitfalls of race by knitting together King's story with the personal stories of blacks and whites at the highest and lowest stations within the movement, along with the stories of the politicians who became the movement's enemies and allies. And there was more Branch wanted to add to the already extensive documentation of the civil rights movement.
Well, I wanted to add heart and drama, which are the two things that I found most lacking in the civil rights literature that I've been reviewing since I became a professional writer. I remembered that period myself, although I was a latecomer, as so powerful that it could change people's lives against their will. In fact, it changed my life. I was just a high school student who didn't care about politics, and the next thing I knew, the Birmingham sucked me into it and got me interested in politics. But when I started reading the literature, it seemed to me that civil rights history had degenerated into a series of morality plays or kind of set pieces that really had piety, but not the tremendous soul-wrenching and politics-changing drama that I remembered from the 1960s.
Well, your book, Parting the Waters, starts with the founding of the Black Baptist Church and then talks about the subsequent split within the church, and I think that becomes one of the themes through the book, the importance of the Black Church in the Civil Rights Movement, but also the impossibility of King using the National Baptist Black Church as a national base. And I think the first place where we really see the split in King's life is between King and his own father.
Well, that's certainly true. I wanted to start, the Black Church is a self-contained world, and I wanted to give people a sense, because really what the amazing romantic story in the book is a rise of that isolated world that is literally invisible to white culture in 1950s to the point that it seizes a place in the national and even international stage. But the church world was King's world, and you can't understand King unless you knew what it was like to be a Black Baptist minister in the 1940s. And really that opens the door to understand the relationship between himself and his father, which was tempestuous at best the entire life. Daddy King was a great prince of the church. He, by his own autobiography, he wanted to be a banker and have a big brick house and basically be a potentate. And there were many preachers of his generation who did precisely that. King was always haunted by it. He admired the power. He never rejected the lifestyle, the mannerisms, the careful tradecraft of the big-time preacher who entered at just the right moment and was late and that sort of thing. But he was haunted by the notion that the Cadillac-driving preachers, as he criticized his contemporaries, were really betraying the great mass of people that supported them.
I think it's interesting to point out that King's father was a Republican, voted for Richard Nixon.
Well, it's easy to forget in these days that the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, was the party of choice for most American blacks for almost a century. Franklin Roosevelt made some inroads into that during the Depression, but really prestige republicanism was prominent among blacks, and believe it or not, still is to this day, although you will find very difficult time documenting it unless you go around to some of the old conservative, prestigious black families. They're still Republicans. Martin King voted for Eisenhower in 1956, and Eisenhower carried the black vote in 1956. So this is, the civil rights movement was part of a shift in American politics that lives with us to this day and didn't automatically happen.
Martin Luther King Jr. was involved in a big feud with the head of the National Baptist Convention, J.H. Jackson.
Yes.
And he opposed King, he opposed the sit-ins of the civil rights movement, he opposed much of the civil rights movement. At one of the national conventions, King wanted to figure out whether he should publicly support Jackson's opposition or not. At that convention, there was literally a wedge of opposing black preachers who took over the stage where J.H. Jackson's people were. Could you describe that scene, what happened and what it meant?
Well, it meant a great deal. It was the scene itself was somewhat like a Teamsters convention. It was chaos. It's 10,000 ministers jammed into a giant hall in Kansas City, and it was billed as the great showdown between the civil rights forces and the conservative forces within this National Black Baptist Church, which is an organization. The significance of which is hard for most whites to appreciate. Because the church was so central a black institution, it's important. It was almost like the Vatican in European culture before the Reformation. This was the organization in which preachers made their names. And on this showdown day, King and the civil rights forces were coming to try to take charge of the convention, and King hoped to fulfill his dream to use the organized power of a massive church to literally overwhelm segregation, to call on a certain day. His dream was that he could call on a certain day and use the power of the church to organize ministers and Baptists from all over the nation to descend on a certain place and sit in against segregation. However, at this, the church was divided, and the great J.H. Jackson, who was organized against him for political and racial reasons and a lot of other things, they were ready. There was bedlam in the hall. There literally was fighting and shoving matches. And one preacher was a Jackson supporter, was knocked off the podium and suffered a concussion and later died. J.H. Jackson won the vote that day and all but accused King of being responsible for murdering his fellow who had died, and then read King out of the church so that King was in effect, excommunicated from his own national church. This was a tremendously significant event in that it meant that King lost his dream of using the organized power of the black clergy against segregation in an almost traditional way, and therefore he had to go more to personal sacrifice, going to jail and street demonstrations on its own. To me, it was also significant because not a word of all of this escaped into the white press, even though conservative whites and segregationists might well have used it very much to their advantage in saying that King and his civil rights agenda had been rejected by his own ministers.
My guest is Taylor Branch, and he's the author of the new book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963. You write, too, about how the Kennedys tried to use Martin Luther King in part to gain the black vote. Kennedy realized he needed the black vote to win in 1959, and his first choice of somebody to help shift the black support to Kennedy was Jackie Robinson, but he was a Republican. The second choice was Adam Clayton Powell, but he wanted a lot of money to do that. He asked for about $300,000. And then the Kennedy campaign people thought Martin Luther King would be very helpful to the campaign. When Martin Luther King was in jail once after a sit-in, John F. Kennedy called Coretta King, who was at the time pregnant, and sent his best, and she... why don't you explain what the call was like?
Well, the call actually was the result of clandestine maneuver, really, within the Kennedy campaign, largely on the part of Sergeant Shriver, who was very much aware of the minority issues, and that was his job within the campaign. He got Senator Kennedy to call more or less as a courtesy. It caused an enormous amount of friction within the campaign after Robert Kennedy, the campaign manager, found out about it because they were terribly afraid of offending white voters in the South. And Robert Kennedy chewed them out, had a tremendous internal fight, forbade them to do anything else like that. But then Robert Kennedy, as was his habit, was always doing something mean and then feeling confessional about it, like a good Catholic, I suppose. And so he called and made his own telephone call down there to the judge, wondering why Martin Luther King was being held at 4 months hard labor for a traffic ticket. And Sergeant Shriver then, the new part of the book, what I try to get into is how exactly it happened that they used this information, the Kennedy campaign, to win the 1960 election. It's been disclosed before that this was important. But the details that I get into are basically how the Shriver and Harris Wofford and some of the people behind the scenes in the Kennedy campaign ran a clandestine operation, secret from John and Robert Kennedy themselves, to publicize these incidents in pamphlets delivered in within a week, almost 2 million of them, shortly before the 1960 election. And what they did was that they used the church organization that King had been building within the National Black Baptist Convention. This pamphlet, which was disseminated all over the country on Shriver's own money, secret from his own bosses, got a dramatic shift in the black vote. They shifted 40 points from 1956, and by all polls, it was not expected until that last weekend. So, in some degrees, this operation was responsible, critical sense, it was responsible for John Kennedy's election. And the great irony is that Sarge Shriver never got the credit for doing it.
Well, you describe how this group set up a dummy committee of black preachers so that it would seem as if the black preachers had printed the brochures and had distributed them to the black churches.
That's right, because the campaign and Shriver's people were terrified that if the Kennedy campaign were publicly identified as the source of these pamphlets touting basically Martin Luther King and the black races in connections with the Kennedys, that it would cause a backlash in the South among white voters, and more personally for Shriver, that it would make his brother-in-law, John Kennedy, furious with him. So he did it secretly through the church.
Could you give us some idea of what these pamphlets said?
Oh, it just said the candidate, Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, the candidate with a heart versus no comment Nixon. That's basically all it said, that Nixon didn't bother to comment on Martin Luther King's being arrested and sent to hard labor, whereas Senator Kennedy picked up the phone and made what was literally a two-minute courtesy call. Mrs. King, I'm thinking about you. I'm sorry this has happened. So on that relatively small difference, the races and the cultures were so far apart at this time that a small courtesy call like that, if was a matter that had everyone tied in knots within the campaign and could make the difference in an election if properly handled.
I think this pamphlet story and the way it was distributed within the black churches illustrates a point that you made earlier. You said that the black church was virtually invisible to white culture. And the impression I get from your book is that the reason largely why the Kennedy campaign wanted to distribute these pamphlets through the black church was that so the white press couldn't find out about it. They were afraid if the white press got the story that this would alienate white voters.
That's true. It's also true that, of course, only a couple of people in the Kennedy campaign themselves realized this. All they knew was that the church people that were connected with the Kennedys were saying, we can do this, we have ways of doing this that won't involve you. So even the people in the Kennedy campaign, of course, weren't that aware of the organization and the whole world of what was going on inside the black church. That's one reason we don't really understand, I certainly didn't before I started this research many long years ago, that this world that King grew up in, if you don't understand something about what it was like, you're really kidding yourself to think that you could come out of nowhere and understand what he went through, even in becoming the leader of his people, let alone in getting the movement off the ground in the white world as well as the black world.
But here you are, a white reporter, trying to tell this story and trying to understand the world as best as you could. Do you think that you were at something of a disadvantage as a white reporter trying to write a history of the civil rights movement?
Well, everybody's at a disadvantage because no matter what color you are, you're a minority. I think that a black reporter may have had some disadvantage in other parts of the story. This is about J. Edgar Hoover and John and Robert Kennedy and people of all different colors. I think that it's much larger than race, and I think that's the spirit of the whole movement. As a research matter, I didn't really encounter very much resistance once I did my reading and got educated. Most of the time, black people that I interviewed were only too happy to help, because to them it was rare that anybody of any color had shown interest in the real details of what had been going on in that period.
Yeah, you say that in addition to being about Martin Luther King and leaders of the civil rights movement, the book is also about Hoover and Kennedy. And I want to talk with you a little bit about that after we take a short break. My guest is Taylor Branch, author of the new book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Taylor Branch is my guest, and he's a former staff member of the Washington Monthly, Harper's, and Esquire. Let's get a little bit into the relationship between Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, and J. Edgar Hoover. It's common knowledge now that Hoover wiretapped Martin Luther King's phone and was really on his tail for quite a long time. Now, Robert Kennedy authorized the wiretap on King. Would you explain what was behind Robert Kennedy's authorization?
Well, it's very difficult to do in a short time. I should say that it was the culmination, really, of a three-year wrestling match between Robert Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover over wiretapping in general, security, organized crime, and their entire relationship. The wiretaps were authorized in October and November of 1963, the last set only a matter of weeks before President Kennedy was assassinated. So really, the wiretaps were the outcome and at the end of basically Robert Kennedy's tenure as Attorney General and at the end of the Kennedy administration. They had what amounted to a long chess match over King and civil rights. Kennedy wanted to get J. Edgar Hoover out of the security and politics business, the business of policing what was American and what was a security risk and that sort of thing, because he thought the FBI was vastly overdeployed in that area and was not fighting organized crime at all. Hoover resisted that ferociously because those political functions were basically what made him autonomous. He made the rules and he was accountable to no one, and the evidence was secret. So he wanted to keep that kind of a role rather than fighting crime the way Robert Kennedy wanted him to. And they came over time to fight this battle really over Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, because basically Hoover was saying, here's where the security threat is. If you want to get me out of security, you've got to be saying there's no threat here, and this is something that's going to be an upheaval and a grave threat to all of America. So they fought, and it was they fought in the Freedom Rides, then they fought all through 1962, and they fought over wiretaps, and it kind of mixed the spy business into acute racial hatreds and politics, and also into fights over really almost a constitutional issue of what kind of FBI ought to be run. And that is a story that ran from start to finish through the Kennedy administration, but ultimately Robert Kennedy gave in. And I had always felt that no explanation of that had made sense before. Kennedy clearly knew that when he handed a wiretap authorization on Martin Luther King to J. Edgar Hoover, he was giving Hoover a trump card and losing a lot of his hope of controlling him. And toward the end of the book, there are several factors, including some unsavory ones that I think came into play. Hoover was protecting Robert Kennedy against the public knowledge or possibility that public knowledge might emerge that President Kennedy had been involved in a sex scandal with an East German woman that Hoover thought was a spy. So you even have some of these more salacious tabloid-type Kennedy sex stories that we've seen lately at that time coming into play into this twisted wrestling match between the Kennedys and Hoover over King and the fate of the civil rights movement.
See, there's really an element of blackmail in there.
Well, I think basically so. Hoover was too smart. He was a genius as a bureaucrat. He's not going to go in there and say, Mr. President, I'm saving your... Mr. Attorney General, I'm saving the president's neck here on this sex scandal. He's done it again. And if you don't give me the wiretap, I'm going to blow the whistle. He would never do that, but he would go in. And in fact, some of the documents are the same. The King documents and the sex scandal documents are two different files, but they're the same conversations, which was a great discovery for me in my research. He would go in and say, I'm very concerned. The FBI is very concerned. We found out this information about the president. We desperately want to help. And by the way, we're having this trouble over here with King, and that even though he's just delivered the I Have a Dream speech and has shaken America and waked it up and is very popular, I, J. Edgar Hoover, still consider him the prime security threat, and won't you help me out? So it was done in a kind of a courtly, polite way, but everybody who was involved on the inside knew what the nature of the game was, and it was a, and indeed it did turn out to be true that once Kennedy gave in and signed that wiretap authorization, he literally lost control over Hoover. He was signing more wiretaps within a matter of days, and then of course the assassination happened, and it fell away altogether.
I want to read one of the last sentences, well, actually the two last sentences that you close your book with. You write, King, this is, by the way, after Kennedy's assassination and after the March on Washington, and you write, King has crossed over as a patriarch, like Moses, into a land less bounded by race. To keep going, he became a pillar of fire. Can I ask you to elaborate on that?
Well, what I'm saying is that, you know, the title of this book is Parting the Waters, and I'm working on a sequel about the Johnson years entitled Pillar of Fire. What I'm, these are both from the book of Exodus, the story of, and black culture, black church culture and political culture are heavily influenced by Hebrew history, and which is why I take both of my titles out of Exodus. Pillar of Fire refers to the, and of course the symbolism here is just as the Hebrews passed over out of slavery from Egypt and thought they were going into the Promised Land, so too did the blacks several times, and in this case during the Civil Rights Movement. But instead of going directly into Promised Land, both of them went into the wilderness period, an in-between period that was difficult. And for the Hebrews, according to the book of Exodus, they were guided at night by a pillar of fire that appeared before them. And what I'm suggesting by way of metaphor here for the second book, which is what I'm working on now, is that King literally consumed himself during the period when he went from Nobel Peace Prize winner and someone whose reputation stood high in the entire world, which was a miracle in itself, a great story. But then he became popular. He became rejected by all sides, including the black militants, the white militants, and he got consumed by Vietnam, by blackmail, by the threats over the revelations about his own private life. And this really is King's epiphany, the period when he was a pillar of fire in the sense that he was consumed by his own internal passions. And the greatness of King was that they drove him back down to Memphis, where he died among garbage workers. And that is a real, almost religious epiphany for him during that period to have lit up the world, even though his own life was in such a crucible of destruction.
I have to assume that you've been changed by the experience of researching and writing the book, and I'd like to know what assumptions you had were challenged by the research that you did, by the new things that you learned.
Well, an awful lot of them. I didn't realize that it would take, in effect, learning at least the beginnings of a new language to understand the culture that King grew up in. And I feel stupid for that, because if the Civil Rights Movement didn't taught us one thing, it was that the races were pretty far apart and didn't understand each other, and yet we tended to think that because we passed the Civil Rights Bill, well, gosh, we know everything we need to know, and we're now fully educated, and that wasn't true. I think the biggest thing, though, was to realize, for me, as far as King is concerned, how much pressure he was under from within his own world, and how much of him was defined by his relationship with the students. In many parts of this story, the students are ahead of King, and he knows it, and he's the first to pay tribute to him, and he's in turmoil over it. And when you realize what a he was as a young man, he was kind of a pedant. He was a sweethearted aristocrat. And when you realize how royal and how princely his early life was within his own culture, I respect all the more what he gave up and what he risked to lead a movement that would go to jail, in Birmingham in particular, when the whole movement was literally about to go down the tubes, to make the decision to send second and third graders by the hundreds into jail in Birmingham, which is a rough town, is an unbelievable decision. And now that I have children, I can appreciate that, but I can't really appreciate what it would have been like to be a black person in Birmingham doing that in 1963. This is a truly religiously and morally and politically, it is a great upheaval, and it moved me deeply to be to get as close to it as I could in researching this book.
Yeah, you point out that in many ways the students were ahead of King in terms of being willing to go to jail and realizing that the power they would have, the power that they would get in going to jail for acts of civil disobedience. King was for a while reluctant to align himself with the sit-ins, knowing that everyone would be arrested. Why was he initially reluctant?
Well, part of that was because he was a preacher, and he hoped to convert. Preachers are evangelists, and they hope to preach. Segregation is wrong. Racial justice is vital in the world. The world is too small for this kind of prejudice. And King knew all the lines, and he was a genius at preaching. And as an orator alone, he may be the last great classical orator of this century. So with some good reason, he hoped not to have to go to jail. I mean, the preacher's way of doing it is to find a big enough audience, convert people, have them turn away, and change, which is why he was trying to take over his own church to do that, and it was why he was trying to make an alliance with Billy Graham in the 1950s, who was one of his friends. So for him, the notion that oratory alone and that truth wouldn't work and that America would cling to segregation in spite of the truth that he was preaching was very difficult for him. It was like an admission that his profession was a failure or could not work or was ineffective. And the students taught him that sacrifice and drama and going to jail and that sort of thing have greater potency in the world than truth alone and the spoken word. And that was hard for him to admit. Plus the fact that when you grow up with all of his privileges and the acute awareness that middle-class status for blacks is not as secure as it is, we tend to assume for whites that once you're middle class and secure, you're going to stay that way. For blacks, it had been a long, hard sweat over many generations, and they were acutely aware that with one slip or going to jail or some blot on their record, they could slide back down into the underclass. So both because he wanted so desperately for the ministry to work and because he was personally afraid for the consequences of what would happen, he knew that the road of sacrifice pointed toward not just jail and being beaten and that sort of thing, but for somebody of his stature and his visibility, the possibility of martyrdom. And he spoke about that his entire career.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Taylor Branch's new book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, is published by Simon & Schuster. It was just nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Gerald Posner. His new book, Warlords of Crime, Chinese Secret Societies, the New Mafia, investigates the Chinese gangs called triads that now dominate the international heroin trade. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Carolyn Heilbrunn. She's a feminist professor of literature who's interested in the stories of women who have led unconventional lives. She's created such a character herself in detective novels written under the pseudonym Amanda Cross. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Fred Astaire's singing. The jazz sessions he recorded in the 1950s have just been reissued. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Roots: The Gift. It's a new made-for-TV movie set 7 years after the slave Kunta Kinte's arrival in America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. A federal grand jury in Charlotte, North Carolina, today indicted one-time TV evangelist Jim Baker for fraud. Baker's top aide, Richard Dortch, was also indicted on the fraud charges, and two other church officials were charged with tax evasion. But Baker's wife, Tammy, was not included in the indictment. Baker and Dortch are charged with diverting funds raised for church activities to their own use. Together, the two are accused of defrauding donors of more than $4 million. Democratic National Chairman Paul Kirk today said he won't be seeking another 4-year term as his party's leader. As NPR's Cokie Roberts reports, Kirk's withdrawal could lead to bloody infighting among Democrats.
A good many professional politicians had urged Paul Kirk to stay on as chairman of the Democratic Party. Not only did they want to show support for the job the Boston lawyer has done over the last 4 years, but many Democrats wanted to avoid the fight that Kirk's decision to leave has precipitated. 5 men have already indicated they are interested in the job as party chairman. Washington lawyer Ron Brown, who was an operative in the Jesse Jackson campaign, Michigan State Party Chairman Rick Wiener, and 3 former congressmen, Jim Jones of Oklahoma, Michael Barnes of Maryland, and Jim Stanton of Ohio. The fight is expected to bring out all of the differences in the Democratic Party, racial, regional, and ideological, and could create hostilities that will make unification before the next presidential election difficult. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Democrats and Republicans in the House have reelected Representative Jim Wright and Bob Michael as majority and minority leaders, respectively. Michael threw down the gauntlet to Democrats, calling on them to reform House ethics standards and election campaign practices and limit outside speaking fees. There was no comment from Wright, who is himself the subject of an ethics investigation. The tension ebbed in Argentina today, but the military uprising, which began Friday, does not appear to be completely over, and there are a host of doubts about possible secret deals between the government and the rebels. Peter Ford reports.
When President Raul Alfonsín announced the end of the military uprising on Sunday night, he said his government had made no concessions to the mutineers. That prompted 2 questions. If there were no concessions, why did the rebels surrender? And if they have in fact surrendered, why are they still in control of the barracks they seized and still carrying their guns? These questions have no clear answers yet, and nor do many others. Military sources are claiming that rebel leader Colonel Mohamed Ali Zain el-Din won a promise from army chiefs to meet some at least of his demands. Government ministers deny any such thing, but Zain el-Din did not capitulate before any great show of force. Indeed, there are doubts whether the generals themselves were unwilling to strike against the mutineers or whether they simply could not find enough troops they could count on to open fire. Most Argentines are skeptical of Alfonsín's pledge that there was no deal. But the most worrying of all the possibilities for the president is that Zain el-Din and the Army High Command have made a deal behind his back, and that not even he knows what they're planning next. For National Public Radio, this is Peter Ford in Buenos Aires.
Ford Motors said today it has signed a confidentiality pact with the Soviet Union covering discussions about the production of American cars there. There's been speculation that Ford might be allowed to produce cars at a Gorky plant if it agreed to modernize the aging facility. A trade publication has said Ford would be likely to build 100,000 Scorpio models annually at the Gorky plant to be used for military, official, and private purposes. The Ford car would replace the Volga luxury car currently built at the Gorky plant. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has canceled a visit to the United Nations because of restrictions placed on his delegation by the U.S. government. Nicaragua's ambassador to the U.N. says the U.S. has held up 17 visas requested by the Nicaraguans. Stocks were up on Wall Street. The Dow closed up over 31 points. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that for a song and dance man, Fred Astaire didn't have much of a voice. But on stage and in the movies, Astaire introduced dozens of great songs. Many of them are included on a new reissue of a 1952 set featuring Astaire backed by a jazz sextet.
Dancing in the dark till the tune ends. We're dancing in the dark, and it soon ends. We're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by, we're here and gone.
Fred Astaire made singing before a microphone an act of dancing in the dark. He seems to have a range of about six notes and all the lung power of a chain smoker. But when he's singing at his best, you can almost see him gliding across the floor or doing some fancy steps. Here's Fred Astaire on a cut from a 2-CD reissue on Verve, The Astaire Story, recorded in 1952.
Holding hands at midnight, neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Now just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask for anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
Even by his own standards, Astaire isn't in the greatest voice on these sessions. But The Astaire Story is a winner anyway, because of the material and because of the band. Producer Norman Granz conceived the project to showcase some three dozen classic songs Astaire had introduced. Songs by the likes of Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, and George Gershwin, many of which became jazz standards. The Players amounted to the Verve House Band. Charlie Shavers on trumpet, Flip Phillips on tenor sax, Barney Kessel on guitar, Oscar Peterson on piano, Ray Brown on bass, and Alvin Stoller on drums. Stoller's the least known, but Astaire liked him enough to use him as his drummer on TV specials years later. The music is lightly textured, but swings like mad. On Irving Berlin's No Strings, Oscar Peterson plays his dancing solo on Celesta, sort of a keyboard glockenspiel.
No strings and no connections, no ties to my affections. I'm fancy free and free for anything fancy. No dates that can't be broken, no words that can't be spoken, especially when I am feeling romancy. Like a robin upon a tree, like a sailor that goes to sea, like an unwritten melody, I'm free, that's me. So bring on the big attraction, my decks are cleared for action. I'm fancy free and free for anything fancy.
Astaire talks a bit, too, so I'll let him introduce the next piece.
You know, this album is a kind of jazz album, too, and jazz means the blues. Oscar, Barney, Alvin, and Ray are going to ad-lib some of those blues now, and I'm going to walk in and throw a little hoofing in there.
Thank you.
Astaire also plugs two songs of inferior quality, his own. Not My Girl is more interesting for Desmond Carter's masochistic lyric than for Astaire's tin pan music.
I've read about those tender girls, those ready to surrender girls. I've got one of a tougher kind, rougher kind, the make men suffer kind. Who's sweet to me, not my girl? Who's kind to me, not my girl? You want to know what my girl can be? Listen to me. The sight of her wakes man up. A day with her shakes man up. She practically breaks man up. She's not an Annabelle Lee. Without her, I could not exist. The way that she loves is frightening. And on the day that she and I first kissed, I thought I was struck by lightning. Who's heavenly, not my girl? Who wants to be not my girl? If only you'd got my girl, you know what's the matter with me.
The composer Alec Wilder once wrote that every tune written for Fred Astaire seems to bear his mark, that Astaire brought out in composers, quote, something better than their best, a little more subtlety, sophistication, wit, and style. Wilder was right, Astaire's own tunes aside. So when jazz musicians play some of those classic songs, a little of Fred's elegance rubs off. The nice thing about the Astaire story is that for once, he gets to inspire musicians directly. You can tell they feel the spirit. Everyone's in vintage form, except maybe the guy with the shaky voice.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the Astaire story on Verve Records.
Let's dance forever, come on, say we'll never be through. Oh, it's so easy to dance with you.
This is Fresh Air. Carolyn Heilbrunn is a feminist professor of literature. She collects biographies and is a student of the form. In her new book, Writing a Woman's Life, she observes that men's stories are usually described as quests, whereas women have only two narratives available to them, the conventional marriage and the erotic plot. Heilbrunn wants to suggest new ways of writing about the lives of women. Heilbrunn is especially interested in unconventional women. She's created such a woman in the detective novel she writes under the pen name of Amanda Cross. But when it comes to autobiography, Heilbrunn finds that even unconventional women follow convention when telling their own stories.
What's most interesting is when extraordinary women write autobiographies. They've had extraordinary lives, but they write about themselves as though it all just sort of happened, and they reluctantly filled the role of head of state or whatever it might be. Because women simply were not allowed to admit to ambition or power, the desire for power, or which could they say they ever suffered. It was always other people who suffered.
What's an example of an autobiography like that that you have in mind?
Jane Addams, Golda Meir, Eleanor Roosevelt. My favorite is Ida Tarbell, who brought down the Standard Oil of New Jersey single-handed, and who in her autobiography just happened to meet someone who happened to come along when she happened to be sewing. Their letters, of course, are very different.
In an earlier book, you wrote about androgyny, and you said the ideal toward which I believe we should move is best described by the term androgyny. I'd like to know what you meant by androgyny and if you still feel that way.
What I meant at the time, and one has to remember that when I wrote that book, the term androgyny was very new indeed and very frightening.
And this is what year?
It came out in 1973, and it was not the common word it has become since. And many book reviewers became very upset by it.
They probably thought you meant a hermaphrodite.
Yes, or they thought you meant heaven knows what. I mean, we rely so much on stereotypical views of gender. As I say somewhere in the book, quoting someone, a man only is a man by defining himself against women. When I wrote this, I hoped for an ideal of a spectrum along which individuals could take their places without regard to the appropriate. The term androgyny has actually become less in favor with feminists whom I honor because it does seem to insist upon only two, a binomial sense, which is probably not good, because the media took it up so much, and because in history, while men always were willing to adopt certain feminine qualities, they resented very much women's adopting masculine ones.
Since your new book is about women who've lived unconventional lives and how their stories have been told in autobiography or biography, I'm interested a little bit in your life and if you were interested when you were young in living an unconventional life.
Oh, no. Nobody dared to live an unconventional life in the 1950s. I was unconventional, amazingly enough, in not having children until I was what was then considered very old, 30. Now I think that's rather young to have a child. And I never moved to the suburbs because I didn't want to be a chauffeur and so on, and I always worked. I suppose those made me unconventional, but of course I hid it behind an extraordinarily conventional life, which I still live. and that does make me a little questionable, I think.
What do you mean it makes you questionable?
Well, it's very easy to urge other people to a kind of courage one never had to have oneself.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, since I'm older, I've become much more courageous and feisty and so on, and that's why I think, one of the reasons I think it's such an opportunity.
Why do you think you've become more courageous
partly,
since you've gotten older?
Well, partly, of course, it's the women's movement. There are more women out there. We talk to each other. You don't feel all alone and peculiar and odd, at least not on the East Coast. Also, you know, there's nothing more they can do to me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, my children are grown. I've got a job. What can they do to me? Only what they've already done, which is call me a feminist and so forth. One has to have the courage then to speak to young people, to speak for young people, I mean to say, who, after all, have to worry about keeping their jobs, raising their children, and so on, and they can't take these risks. So I think we who are older have to take them for them.
When you were young, you started reading the British detective novelist Dorothy Sayers, and her work was very important to you, and I guess was responsible in part for you eventually writing detective novels. What did you find in her novels that really spoke to you?
Well, first of all, the English detective novels were all about intelligent people who sat around chatting to each other. They weren't like these American ones with a lot of men killing each other and beating each other up and bleeding all over the place. So, first of all, I liked that. Second of all, of course, I was an Anglophile. I taught and still teach British literature. But also her whole sense, I mean, if you speak about androgyny, the Sayers and the other women and some of the men writers, their characters, the men and women, are not locked in prisons of gender. You know, they are people, and they talk to each other. And then with Sayers and Gaudy Knight, of course, she gave us the first real community of intelligent women, and that was an extraordinary thing to do.
In 1964, you started writing detective fiction under the pen name of Amanda Cross. What did you want to write within that genre?
I wanted to see what a woman who had everything, that is to say, she had enough money, which you have to have so you can hop on a plane to chase a criminal and so forth, and who had a job, had education, had everything, what she could do with it that was more than what it seemed to me women were doing around the world. And she was, of course, a fantasy figure. She's got a little more realistic lately.
Why did you write under a pen name instead of using your own?
Because I knew I wouldn't get tenure if they knew I was writing detective novels. It's that simple.
Is popular culture that despised in academia?
Yeah, well, they wouldn't say they despise it, but you shouldn't be spending your time writing novels. You should be spending your time writing critical articles. And it was much worse when I was young than it is now, probably.
Was anyone ever on to you?
No, I must say it was a perfectly kept secret until 1972. After I wrote Poetic Justice, a few people began to guess. That's the one that takes place at a university that might be thought to be Columbia.
So did anyone confront you with it?
Oh, yes, a good bit after that. And then the secret was out and it didn't matter. But it was totally a secret before then.
Do you still see academia as a good place for furthering feminist thought?
Oh, yes, very much so. As I said in the beginning of my book, Writing a Woman's Life, the only problem is that the feminist theoreticians in academia have been so brilliant and have gone so far. They've really been extraordinary. And I worry that that is not being translated sufficiently into something both available and interesting to more women all over who need it. Not that that's the job of the academicians by any means, but you know, the media picks up whatever is easy and sexy and so forth.
You know, it's interesting to me that several really interesting feminist thinkers have devoted some of their writing to literary criticism. Even The Second Sex, one of the most important feminist texts and one of the first in the resurgence of feminism, had several chapters devoted to literature in it.
Well, that's right, because mainly that's where we get our stories from, at least before television. We got our stories from literature. We got our stories from the books we read and so forth. And literature, of course, even when it was written mostly by men, and this is something I find very interesting, they use women characters very much in ways that question the whole gender structure, even at the same time that they uphold it. It's the business of literary people to understand what goes on underneath the text, and that's why they do this very well and use literature.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Carolyn Heilbrunn's new book, Writing a Woman's Life, is published by Norton. A new Amanda Cross detective novel is due out in the spring. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. How are you?
You preparing for a Gorbachev's visit?
You bet. Gorby goes Gotham. We're all practicing our New York tabloid headlines. We'll be hearing from Ann Garrels about what's anticipated, and also Dan Shore analyzing those events for us. Also, news that Paul Kirk, Democratic National Committee chairman, will not stay on, and that opens up the Democratic Party to a potential battle for control of the National Committee. News of Jim Baker, of Jim and Tammy Baker fame, being indicted, and a talk with Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, the author of Balm and Gilead. She's a Harvard professor, and it's a story about her mother, a psychoanalyst of a very famous black intellectual family.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Another chapter in Roots history will be revealed next Sunday on television. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of the latest production about Kunta Kinte.
It's not every day that a TV Christmas special begins with a scene of someone getting whipped. But it happens this weekend, and it's not even a new scene. It was first shown on television nearly 12 years ago.
Your name is Toby. What's your name?
Kunta.
Lord God, help that boy. They're going to whip him dead.
That, of course, is from an early episode of Roots, with LeVar Burton as Kunta Kinte and Louis Gossett Jr. as the older, less rebellious fiddler. But it's also the opening scene of Roots the Gift, a new ABC telemovie that revives two of the strongest characters from Roots and places them in a new drama set at Christmas time, but with very little holiday cheer. Roots the Gift takes place in 1775, 7 years after Kunta Kinte was brought from Africa on a slave ship and whipped into submission. Kunta and Fiddler accompany their master on a visit to the Parker Plantation, where the ruling family embodies the range of attitudes among whites in the Old South. The plantation owner, played by John McMartin, is an out-and-out bigot. His wife, played by Michael Learned, is very fond of her household servants, but can't come to think of them as equals. And their Harvard-educated son, played by Sean Cassidy, is a secret abolitionist. Kunta and Fiddler also cross paths with a ruthless bounty hunter, a woman, played by Kate Mulgrew, and a free man of color whom she apprehends. He's played by Avery Brooks, who, like Gossett and Burton, gives this drama an awful lot of power and dignity. And before long, Fiddler and Kunta decide to make a run for it.
Freedom. Freedom. That's something make a man want to risk his life for? Phyllis. It's a chance to be who you was born to be. And you don't have to ask no white man or nobody for nothing.
You reckon that this freedom, something I can learn?
Why don't we go and see?
Roots the Gift is no Roots ripoff. Alex Haley wrote it, David L. Wolper is the executive producer, and it's a lot better than Roots, which remains the most popular miniseries ever shown on TV. Its official sequel, 1979's Roots the Next Generations, is also in the all-time miniseries top 10, so ABC has actually been quite restrained to wait this long before mounting another Roots project. And since this is a sure bet to be utilized as an annual holiday special, it's nice to see one that finally deals with the black experience, even from such a bleak historical period. The show's only drawback is fitting it properly into the Roots saga. Although we're rooting for Kunta Kinte to reach freedom, we know from the original Roots that he won't. In Roots, he died in slavery. But if Fiddler and Kunta fail to escape this time, what's to keep them from trying again? It sounds like the makings of another Roots chapter. And if Roots the Gift gets the reception I expect it to, Alex Haley and ABC will probably provide it.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we speak with poet Robert Pinsky. His new collection of essays has just been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for Literary Criticism. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles guitarist Slim. Ed calls Slim an important link between black music's past and present. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of Ezra Pound. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.